You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 7:30 and time once again for Community Forum. And we are lucky to have with us this morning Ray Levine, who has recently returned from Palestine, Israel, working over there as part of Freedom Summer with the ISM.
International Solidarity Movement.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's start out and let me ask you, why did you choose at this point in time to go to what many consider like a hotbed in the world?
Sure. Well, I guess quite a few people told me that it was crazy to do that. I went because, for one thing, I'm Jewish, and I've been watching what's been happening in the Middle East for many years, and what Israel is doing is being done in my name as well as the name of Jews all over the world. And I've been shocked, abhorred, outraged at Israel's treatment of Palestinians for many, many years. The invasion in April was an extreme horror and definitely got me wanting to go over there. I really have felt compelled to go there, both as a Jew and as an American. Our taxpayer dollars is what's funding Israel to be able to do what it's doing. So I just felt compelled to go and see for myself and to stand up and say to people there, as well as people here, that I don't agree with what Israel is doing, and I want to see an end to the occupation.
Now, you went with the, as part of the International Solidarity Movement's Freedom Summer. How did you hear about them? How did you get involved with that?
Well, I've been hearing about the International Solidarity Movement over the past year. There are folks here in Seattle who have gone on previous campaigns that the ISM has done last summer, as well as in December. The International Solidarity Movement is a relatively new organization over the past year, and they've focused on doing direct action in support of the nonviolent resistance of the Palestinian people to the occupation. So I'd heard of other people going and the experiences that they'd had and the positive impact that it had on people there. I think all solidarity activities have the effect of letting people know, that letting the people who are struggling know that they're not alone. And I heard this time over and over again by people in Palestine saying, why has the world abandoned us? You know, we feel very alone.
Did you have an answer to that when they'd ask you?
Why is the world abandoning us? Well, the way I understand it here in this country is that the pro-Israel lobby in Congress has tremendous power, and the United States is a major force in the world supporting Israel. It's interesting because I think, especially talking to a lot of the Europeans who were there as part of the ISM, in Europe, there are seems to be a lot more support for the Palestinians, and yet the United States is so strong in the UN, it sort of knocks out the support from the rest of the world that the Palestinians would feel.
Now, you, as part of your trip, went over with your son, is that correct?
Yes, I did, yeah. My son, who's 27 years old and lives on the East Coast.
Did you have any second thoughts about that prior to leaving, taking your son along on something that could potentially be dangerous?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we both did. My son is, of course, you can't see this because we're talking on the radio, but I'm about 5'3", and my son is about 6 feet tall. So we each have our own protectiveness of the other. I feel protective towards him because I'm his mother, and he feels protective towards me because he's so much bigger. And so we both went through a lot of soul-searching and wondering before we went about, yes, we were putting ourselves in a situation that could be dangerous to us, and feeling more afraid for the other one than for for our own self.
All right, so tell me about what transpired. This was, you left back in June, is that correct?
Yeah, June 18th or so.
Okay, and where did you arrive, and what did you end up doing?
Okay, we arrived in Tel Aviv, which we had been told could be a little bit sketchy, that there have been groups of people arriving for work with the Freedom Summer who have been turned back at the airport. We had no problem, and we went to Jerusalem and then had a couple days of training. Spent a couple days in Ramallah, and actually went to the what's called the Mukatta, the government building, Arafat's headquarters in Ramallah, and saw the incredible destruction of that whole compound that, you know, we heard about in April. Visually, it was quite impressive. And all around Ramallah, there are things destroyed. I have a picture of three cars, squashed cars, piled on top of each other and turned into a sculpture, essentially, by people there, painted. And some kids painted hearts on them. I mean, they've done some creative things with the destruction. But it's pretty dramatic to see it. We spent a night there with a medical relief committee sleeping in a medical relief committee office, because those places have been targeted, and there was an expectation that all of Ramallah was going to be invaded and that the medical relief committee would be invaded also. So we spent the night there. It turned out it wasn't invaded that night, but several nights later Ramallah was reinvaded. Then we went from there to Nablus and spent the bulk of our time in Nablus. And again, we're working with the medical relief committee as the sort of focal point of our work, and spent a lot of time riding around in the ambulance. The ambulances have been targeted they've been shot. The ambulance drivers, I've heard countless stories of the ambulance driver and the doctors being made to stand in the hot sun, take all their clothes off, and, you know, be strip searched over and over again, be left standing in the hot sun while the ambulances search, you know, Band-Aid by Band-Aid for hours. So we rode with the ambulance day and night to make sure that they could be able to do their work. And the role of the ambulance is incredibly important during curfew, because the whole population is essentially under a 24-hour house arrest. People can't go anywhere under curfew. So the normal things that people can go to the clinic for, to get a shot that they get on a regular basis, or just to see a doctor, or even to get medication, people cannot go out of their house to do these things. So besides the emergencies, the ambulance, there are about 10 or 15 ambulances in Nablus. The medical relief committee ambulance particularly is the one that goes around and takes people their medication and has the doctor in the ambulance, so that somebody who's supposed to get a shot, the ambulance goes to the house and the doctor will go and give the person the shot. And then we had numerous pregnant women and people who had serious illnesses. There's also many people who are just experiencing, you know, whether it's hypertension or, you know, exaggeration of chronic conditions that they have because of the incredible stress that they're under. So the ambulance is the force that's going around the city really tending to people. And, you know, occasionally, like, there would be a call that some family is completely without bread, and the ambulance was going in that direction to take care of somebody, and they would take bread to people because under curfew, people can't go anywhere. And whatever the shortages were, they were trying their best to take care of them.
Now, under international laws, ambulances are not supposed to be touched. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the moments that was really poignant to me was we were riding down the street in the ambulance, and you have to picture, the streets are completely empty. And this is a very bustling city of about 200,000. The streets are empty. We're riding down the street in the ambulance, and directly across from us, coming the other way, is a tank. So the tank kind of rumbles up, and the ambulance slows down, because you're never quite sure whether you can keep going or whether, you know, you better stop or you better turn around and go the other way. So the ambulance stops, and the guy comes out of the top of the tank, and he just signals, turn around and go away, just like that. And the ambulance has to turn around and go the other way. I mean, we were headed that way to pick up somebody that was sick, but the ambulance went, shh, turn around, go the other way, and there off we went. And it was just very clear that the soldiers had control over everything.
So did you find other routes then to get to where you were going?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There were always alternate routes, and we did a lot of driving around to avoid or go someplace where the soldiers were not wanting us to go. The ambulance did everything it possibly could to get to every place that it could go.
So when you're riding in this ambulance, how many of you are in the ambulance? Are you riding what we would call shotgun in the passenger seat? Or?
Well, actually, there's a doctor riding shotgun. So there's the driver, and the ambulance is like a, you know, it's like a Chevy van. So it's a little bit different than what ambulances look like here. So there's a driver and a doctor, and then there's a couple of seats in the back, and we would go one, two, or three internationals. During the daytime, we would often just have one of us go. At night was when it was a lot more dangerous, and we would typically have two or three of us go. There were many times at night that the ambulance would be driving around and would be made to stop and pull over and get out, that people would have to get out and face the soldiers. And there were times, there were a couple of times my son was in the ambulance when they were just shot at before they were asked to come out, they were shot at, and then they had to get out. And what we would do as internationals is just come out with our hands up with our passports, and so that they would see that there was international presence. And then usually it was not a problem. We heard a lot more stories of the ambulance driver and the doctor having difficulties when we weren't with them in the ambulance than what we experienced when we were with them.
And I have to imagine these can be pretty terrifying situations. Did you eventually get used to it, or did it always remain terrifying?
Well, it was actually surprising to me that it was a lot less terrifying in person than what I had imagined it would be in anticipation. The soldiers are all very young. They're 18, 19-year-olds. And when we often were close enough to them that, you know, we're looking at them right in their faces and they're looking at us, and we actually had conversations with them. So, I mean, our aim was always to relate to them as human beings. And this is part of the principles of the International Solidarity Movement, is to relate with everybody in the situation as human beings and to really try to make contact with the humanity on the other side, not just tactically, I mean, as part of the belief system, to really help foster peace. So making contact with these people, even though clearly we're adversaries, they became more human. And it wasn't terrifying as I had imagined that it would be. And it was very, I guess, heartening is a word, to see that these soldiers, I mean, they're loaded down with all sorts of equipment, you know, the full helmet, bulletproof vest, big rifle, and they come out of, you know, a tank or an armored personnel carrier. They still, you can see fear in their faces. They know that it's not right for them to be there. At some level, you get the feeling that they know that they're they're doing things that are sort of not quite right. And so with many of them, there's an opportunity to sort of reach them a little bit as people. Another thing that we did besides riding in the ambulance was to go and visit the homes of people who had been what we started calling double occupied. So I don't know if that I said quite enough about the general curfew situation, but so picture Nablus, a city of 200,000, under 24-hour curfew day after day for weeks, meaning that no one can leave their home. Generally, people will hang out in front of their homes a little bit, and kids will play in the street, but they won't go very far because they need to be able to kind of disappear into their homes when the tanks and the armored personnel carriers come down the street. So that's the general situation. Then there are 10 to 15 homes that are occupied by soldiers. These people have the soldiers living right in their homes, and it takes different forms. Like, there are apartment buildings where the soldiers will take the top flat, and generally it will be at the high up places. Nablus is like in a valley and with two mountains on the side of it. So there are houses all the way up the mountain on both sides. So the soldiers will take an apartment building that's way high up, so they get a vantage point. They can look down. It's a great sniping location. So they'll take the top flat, and they'll kick the family out, and the family will go and live with another family in the apartment building. And then those buildings are living under a much more restrictive circumstance than the rest of the city. They're not allowed to go between apartments and talk to their neighbors. The kids are not allowed to go outside and play in front of the building or, you know, outside their apartments. The family whose home has been occupied, but is being occupied by the soldiers, is not allowed to go to their home to get anything. And oftentimes when the curfew is lifted, which it is every 4 or 5 days, they will lift the curfew for 4 to 6 hours so people can go out and get food and do basic errands. These buildings that are double occupied, the soldiers often will not let them go out even when the curfew is lifted, or they'll shorten the time frame. If the curfew is lifted at 8, they won't let them go out until 10. It's a constant harassment, humiliation, and very, very repressive regime that these people are living in. So we started visiting all these houses to let the people know that somebody knew about them and to try to help them, support them in their negotiations with the soldiers to get very simple little things, like the family whose apartment was being taken over wanting to go to their apartment and to collect some more of their belongings. That was a big issue with the soldiers. In one of these buildings, a group of us went, and when we approached the building, they have like two tanks and an armored personnel carrier sitting out front of an apartment building. When we first approached, the first thing that the soldiers did was shot over our heads. That was their "Hi, how are you?" Then we sort of kept walking closer, a little bit closer, you know, yelling out loud, "Hello, how are you?" You know, speaking English so that they knew that we were internationals. Gradually getting close enough, and in this one instance, we spent a lot of time just sort of sitting there going, "Please, somebody come out and talk with us." Finally, a couple of soldiers came out and talked with us, and they got pretty close so that we could communicate with them. And eventually, in this one situation where there were two houses, one where they had kicked the family out completely, and then a building facing it where there were still four families living, we were able to arrange for the family that had been kicked out completely to go in and collect some of their belongings. And then we were actually allowed to go in and speak to the four families who all kind of gathered at the stairway to talk with us. We had about 5 minutes, and we just wanted to see if they were okay and if they needed anything. And they're, of course, in all these situations, what the families say is, we need our freedom. And it's very frustrating in that situation to know that, you know, you can't get them their freedom. That's the one thing that we weren't able to help them negotiate. But in this one situation, they wanted their kids to be able to go out and play in front of the building. It seems like such a small request, but not acceptable to the soldiers. So we went back out and tried to talk to the soldiers about, you know, couldn't you please let these kids come out and play for, you know, some portion of the day? And had some conversations with the soldiers where they were saying, look, we don't really want to be here. We don't like being here and taking over these people's homes. We'd rather be home with our families. And then, of course, they go into, you know, why they feel it is necessary. In this instance, they said to us that they didn't allow the kids to come out and play because they could have bombs on them. And we were looking at these kids, you know, like 3, 4, 5-year-olds not being allowed to play, and these soldiers actually imagining that these kids would come out and blow themselves up and kill the soldiers, which was just mind-boggling to me that they could imagine that. Yes, I guess they have experience that there are people who are doing that. I don't know of instances of, you know, 3 and 4-year-old kids doing that. It's, yeah.
So the situation that you experienced in Nablus, do you feel that that was being mirrored across Palestine?
Yeah. All the cities, when we were there, pretty much all the major cities were closed in the same way. We heard that Nablus was facing one of the stricter regimes, and that the Israelis were saying that it was some sort of hotbed of terrorism, and so they were being much more restrictive. Actually, even now, I think in some of the other cities, the curfew has been lifted more often, and Nablus is being held under a tighter regime. You know, we asked all the time, well, is there crossfire? Or, you know, is there anything that it would justify this perception that it's this hotbed of terrorism? And we're told over and over again that there wasn't any crossfire. I mean, nobody was firing back at the soldiers. It's not like there's a conflict where there's warring parties and there are people firing on both sides. What's being experienced in Nablus right now is completely one-sided, with you know, a complete tight military occupation with tanks, armored personnel carriers, soldiers, jeeps all throughout the city, and really random violence to keep people frightened all the time. There are 3 refugee camps in Nablus, and some of our people were staying in at least 2 of them. And in those situations, even more so than in the city, you know, every day or every other day, the tanks would go to the refugee camp and do these forays into the very narrow streets of the refugee camp, and really what seemed to be in a very provocative way, the tanks would kind of roll in, blow dirt into the people's faces, and then roll back, and then they would keep doing it over and over again until finally kids would start throwing stones, and then they would shoot them. And we know that every single day there are people being killed in the West Bank, and most days there are people being killed in Nablus. It's, you know, 1 person, 2 people, 3 people. Every once in a while there will be an incident like what happened in Jenin, where a tank just fired into a crowd, and I think it was in a market, even on a day when the curfew was lifted, and 3 people were killed. And then the Israelis will issue some kind of apology saying, well, you know, we killed the wrong people, or, you know, we made a mistake. Occasionally they will do that, but it doesn't stop them from doing it again. You know, they apologize, well, we killed the wrong people here, but then they will go on the same day and the next day to kill one person, two people, three people, whatever it is. Yesterday, there was a journalist killed. Every day, there are people being killed there, and it's not what we're hearing about in the press, the mainstream press in this country at all. I think people really don't have an idea of the daily horror and violence that's going on there.
Talk about what people in this country, what people who are listening can do.
Yeah. Well, I think there are lots of things people here can do. Starting with tomorrow on Sunday, we will be giving a more extensive report back on the experiences that we have, myself and another person who was there with the ISM, including some video footage that we have of a demonstration that we were involved with. One of the things that we helped organize when we were there in Nablus was the first demonstration of people marching in the streets during the curfew. That was very successful, and we had about 100 people marching for about an hour in the center of the old city and in the center of the city, and about 30 internationals and 70 Palestinians, and it was really considered to be a very brave move for the Palestinians in particular to be out marching during curfew. So tomorrow, Sunday, the 14th, at 3 o'clock at the Independent Media Center on 1415 3rd at Union, we'll be giving a talk about that and showing some video footage. There is an organization, there are probably multiple organizations in Seattle that are working on this issue. The one that I'm most familiar with is the Palestine Solidarity Committee, and if anybody wants to reach PSC, the email is palestinejustice@aol.com. So there's some contact. If people are interested in joining the ISM, the Freedom Summer is continuing through August, and the website to look for is www.palsolidarity.org, palsolidarity.org, if people want information about the ISM. Then there's a whole host of things that people can do as individual citizens as well as in organized effort, like write to the mainstream media, call and write to the mainstream media demanding more coverage of what is going on. We kept hearing about journalists in Jerusalem. Well, there are mainstream journalists in Jerusalem, but they're not in the West Bank. They're not going to the West Bank and to Gaza and reporting on what's going on there. They're kind of hanging out in Jerusalem. Demand of the mainstream media that they cover more of what's going on. And then I think of people constantly contacting our congresspeople and letting them know that we don't want to fund Israel to do these things. Currently, the U.S. is spending something like $4 to $5 billion a year in support for Israel. A large portion of that goes to military support for the settlements, which are a major obstacle to peace. There are settlements all over the West Bank and Gaza of Israelis right in the midst of the Palestinian territories that the army is protecting, and it's really making the situation very difficult. So contacting congresspeople and letting them know that constituents are not in support of what Israel is doing and really would like the United States to urge Israel to have some humane policies. There are growing campaigns around divestment. People are making lots of parallels between what Israel is doing and what South Africa was doing. More and more we're seeing, you know, which companies are doing business with Israel, and I think we will be seeing more of that kind of divestment work going on. People can stop supporting companies that are doing business with Israel. Those kinds of things.
Excellent. All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. So I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Appreciate it.
Just been talking with Ray Levine, a Seattle and Bay Area resident who has just returned from Palestine as part of the Freedom Summer movement that is being sponsored by the International Solidarity Movement.